We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's C-A-T-C-H. I call it a catch cast for some strange reason. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our geeky subjects as myself and the guests. In today's edition, we're celebrating the art and design of our bus companies. Did you realise this was a thing? Maybe you've experienced buses being marketed but just didn't realise. So who would know about this and why? Today we are joined by transport historian Michael Walton. Welcome to the Catchcast, Mike.
Hello.
Now, you've been an aficionado of good design in transport for most of your life. Can I sort of start by asking what first sparked your interest?
It's a really interesting question because I think for me it is the combination of the shape of things, the colour of things, the look of things, places they serve, the people that use it. So it's this big combination of circumstances which I just thought was fascinating, and all movement for me, particularly if it was beautiful, just got me really excited. I just wanted to go there. I wanted to go somewhere. I wanted to do something. I didn't want to just sit at home and watch television. I just wanted to get out. And they were literally the vehicles to do that. And of course, I love cars as well, but that's not the topic today. So it was all quite exciting, really, for me, as I began to appreciate a little bit more some of the big efforts to make travelling by public transport attractive. It sort of slowly dawned on me that art and design was actually one of the critical things to make the experience, I think, magical.
And can you remember maybe one of the, or a few of the earliest pieces of transport that you thought, that's really cleverly designed?
Well, I grew up in the Home Counties, and the local operator was London Transport. There was a central area of London Transport and red buses and, of course, tubes. And they extended way into the country, and the buses were green, and there were Green Line coaches which ran express services back in the day between outlying towns and central London. But the maps that used to be produced were, I thought, magical and beautiful and just so intelligent and interesting, and I just was desperate to get on buses going places, which of course my parents wouldn't really allow, but it was an enduring reminder perhaps of the power of marketing, great marketing, to induce this excitement and wanderlust. So maps was one thing, and we used to travel greatly down to Bournemouth back in the day, Wimborne actually, and where my family lived. And on the road on the way down were the beautiful coaches of Royal Blue, which plied the main roads out of London to the West Country, all sorts of destinations. And they always looked so stunning in their dark blue and cream and elegant. Oh, it was wonderful. And various other bus companies on the way, like Aldershot and District, which had a beautiful two-tone green and cream livery and always seemed very regal and very outstanding. And it's these combinations of things that you just sort of build a picture, which you think, oh, this is so lovely, this is so good. So it engendered an interest which has really survived to this day, but alas, without the enthusiasm that I had probably in the 60s and early 70s.
Well, we may come on to find out why your enthusiasm waned a little bit, but I wonder if you could tell me how a bus or a coach company, trains as well, are marketed. I mean, what does it actually consist of?
Well, the whole point of marketing is to assert to the public the services that you offer. And in a competitive world, and even if transport has been nationalised, it's still very competitive between a private car and other forms of transport which may or may not be provided by the nation. So the competition for attention and, of course, revenue, because without revenue, there's no business. And without business, there's no nothing. So marketing is adding to the product value that you've got. It's persuading or hoping to persuade people that what you do offer as a product is worth trying and actually incentivized to actually use it more and more. So it's a really important, well, vital, it's a vital mechanism of modern life. People complain bitterly about wall-to-wall advertising and wall-to-wall marketing and stuff. But without that, the recognition and the usage of products would be severely diminished. And it's just a fact of life. It's an important fact of life. And there's good marketing and bad marketing. And that's obviously in the eye of beholder. But I sort of really believe that any marketing with a flair and with humour sometimes is worth paying attention to. Doesn't mean you have to buy the product, but it certainly wants you to pay attention, and certainly in terms of buses and coaches, I did.
From what you're saying then, it's not just a recent activity. I suppose marketing of all different types of transport goes back a bit further than the 20th century.
Absolutely. It goes back to the beginning of these services actually being provided. Shipping companies were always busy trying to market their products, both for crews, and of course, back in the day, it was the only means of international travel. The 19th century sort of began, it sort of got more and more sophisticated as the century neared its end. And in the beginning of the 20th century, railways began to get much more proficient in their marketing, and shipping companies also too. And buses and coaches, well, buses didn't really come along until, I suppose, it was after the First World War, and that rapidly developed in the 20s. And then bus and coach companies began to market themselves much more aggressively from that point. Of course, the other great mode of transport at that point, public transport, was trams, but they tended to be terribly local and then weren't really marketed at all because everybody in the town that they operated in knew they were there and what they were doing. So essentially, yes, it's this collection, I suppose, of businesses trying their hardest to attract new custom. And of course, that principle remains today.
And what are some of the earliest pieces of marketing that you've perhaps collected yourself?
I don't really bother with the early stuff. And the reason is it's not particularly sophisticated. Now, I like everything that I collect to have some important element of what I would call agreeable design, something rather lovely to look at, something very tangible and interesting, stylish, without being too gaudy. But even then, that doesn't really matter. So I basically don't really have anything in my collection sort of prior to 1930. I appreciate it, but it's not my thing.
Now, Mike, you've got me thinking of the first time I was struck by a piece of transport marketing. I think it must have been finding an Edwardian Metropolitan Railway timetable at my gran's house. Where do you find your collector's pieces?
Enthusiast fairs and flea markets. But I think when I was young, my approach to the whole thing was quite different. It was visual, and then it turned into the more, slightly more scholarly, I think, the older I got. So I don't think there was a piece of art and design in terms of bus and coach stuff that actually started me off, apart from maps and the look of vehicles, etc., etc. So yes, I think it was a sort of convoluted entry into the world of interest.
Now we'll come on to the real heyday, your favourite era, the 1930s. But wasn't there a little bit of a boom in things like coaches in the 1920s, Mike?
There was. After the First World War, two substantial things happened. Number one, vehicle technology, mechanics, became a lot more reliable. So the vast amount of trucks that were used in the First World War, and very rudimentary they were too, when the war ended and what could be recovered, quite often these trucks were sort of sold to former soldiers or military people because there was this great well of people who had no jobs after the First World War. And a lot of them started off in business as haulage companies using old lorries. And many converted these early trucks into rudimentary buses because there was no local transport apart from walking, cycling, and if you had a local train, a local train. So there was a huge untapped market for local travel. And quickly, the mechanics, the whole business of technology of the day rapidly improved. So we went from stuff like solid tyres to rubber tyres, which gave a far better ride on what were often really, really rough roads. So yes, there was a massive improvement and burgeoning of that sort of business. But at that time, it wasn't really marketed because it was too local. Mm-hmm. That's a very abbreviated history of early bus and coach travel.
So one of the biggest heydays was the 1930s, I guess. And wasn't that the time when they built that huge coach station at Victoria?
Yes. Coaches by this time really began to come into their own as a sort of a major means of transport. Roads were getting better. They were improving. Many more were resurfaced properly. Towns and cities could be better connected. Now, there is a caveat to that because the railway companies viewed coach travel with great alarm because it attracted a lot of their traffic. So railway companies took a huge interest in what bus and coach companies were doing. even to the point that they bought minority shareholdings in these various new companies in order to exert influence on them so they wouldn't overtly compete. Also, there was a new legislation came out in the early 30s, the Road Traffic Act, which stifled the ability for people just to set up a new service and run it without any authority, without any organisation. A situation that somehow nearly repeated itself in the 90s. But it was a very interesting period, because what the railway companies did realise is they could make money out of bus and coach companies that would shareholder dividends, etc., because these companies were well able to serve towns and villages that weren't usefully served or at all by railway companies. And it was slowly begun to be understood that there was a whole new market out there that didn't really like train travel. So a lot of people just, when they got used to going on the coach from nearly their home to nearly where they wanted to go, it was much easier for them. So there was a whole new market was developed. So it was a golden era of expansion.
And what were some of the classic bus and coach company names around during that period?
A lot of the names were rather lovely. United Automobile Company, not that they had any automobiles. West Riding Road Car Company, Lincolnshire Road Car Company, Ribble Motors, Royal Blue, Bristol Greyhound. And of course, the illusion quite often with names and the colours was to be attractive, look attractive, sound authoritative, and also sort of perform this sort of function, I suppose, just instilling confidence in the customer. So it, in itself, it was very good marketing, colour choices, and what name you chose for your business. And of course, in the Isle of Wight's case, it was Southern Vectis. Vectis, of course, as every Isle of Wight resident will know, as being the Roman name for the Isle of Wight.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the Second World War, buses and coaches were in a lot more competition, weren't they, with the rise of private vehicles?
Yes.
So what did they do to market themselves at that point? What was the response?
It was a heyday of really from the period about 1946 to about 1953-54. It was the period of the highest usage, the highest ridership. It became, the railways were really run down after the war, dirty, miserable, because it had been so overused. So bus and coach companies could offer a clean, reliable service, and that attracted an awful lot more people. However, hand in hand with that, particularly after the start of the early 50s, was the rise, inexorable rise, in car ownership. And as the 50s decade progressed, the inexorable rise as well of new motorways and new bypasses, which eased sometimes appalling congestion. It's easy to forget that actually congestion was terrible in the 50s and 60s in most of our towns and villages because there was no bypasses, there was no motorways. So, yeah, there was a very big change there. The other major factor, which of course goes hand in hand with the rise of the automobile or the car, was the fact that families were earning collectively a lot more money and they had more disposable income. And the idea quickly sort of had some sort of outcome, I suppose, for public transport operators, trains and whatever, that actually people once they had a car didn't want to switch back to the old bus, the old coach, the old train. They didn't really want to do that. So one of the things that coach companies did do, they had done it before the war, but they put a lot of effort into long-distance coach cruising, sort of holidays by coach. You're 7 days or 14 days around the Highlands, maybe to the Swiss Alps, maybe to the west of England, maybe to Ireland, who knows. And a lot of them became very proficient. And of course, it was a very lucrative business. And the coach companies were very, very astute at building those businesses and marketed them rather well. And the other thing to be remembered, I suppose, with bus and coach companies, particularly bus, it's at the social spectrum. Buses live at the very bottom. It is not glamorous to go by bus. It's not glamorous. There's nothing glamorous really about it. Coaches, so-so. The glamour is for sea cruising and airlines, particularly in the 50s and the advent of the jet age, became the must-do. So the 2 weeks in Blackpool for the summer rapidly vanished into 2 weeks in Benidorm. So it was a massive change in the industry. So there was a late flowering of coach cruising and the marketing that went with it, often very stylish indeed, before it slowly, well, not even slowly, quite quickly, crashed and burned in the 60s, late 60s. And by the early 70s, it was, as a huge business, pretty well dead.
Bit of a golden era.
Very much a golden era. Killed by wealth, killed by the car, killed by plane travel, killed by, to a degree, the railways, which were slowly finding their feet again with new electrification and sort of rebuilt stations and whatever, trying to regain their foothold as a major provider of public transport in the country. So, yeah, it was a combination of stuff. So really the only thing that survived was express coaches, really. So the rest of it sort of became sort of rather ephemeral and unused.
Now, Michael, I understand you are a bit of a collector of posters and timetables.
Might be, yeah.
Other examples of bus marketing. We'll speak about some more of those in a bit. But do tell us, what's the largest item you have? And don't tell me you own an entire bus.
Oh, no. Oh, heaven knows. It's always going to be, for me, it's always going to be posters. So they're only large in two dimensions and not large, obviously, in three dimensions. So it's posters. So I've got a fairly large poster collection. And one of the things, I suppose, about collecting posters is that they are often by artists that aren't particularly prominent and not really well known, partly because the business of bus and coach operators and their marketing, they were generally very parsimonious. Railways, airlines, shipping companies bought usually the best and usually got the services of famous artists and designers. But bus and coach companies rarely did. So it's quite often a bit amateurish, quite often a bit homemade, and sometimes even pretty poor. But they are rare. They're very rare to find and they're very rare to see around. Not much survives.
You've got quite a collection of posters and timetables, I believe.
Yes, and assorted leaflets and just all sorts of little bits. I don't collect to any formula. I just buy what I like.
I guess they're quite hard to find because most people just throw things away when they're out of date. That's the whole meaning
Indeed.
Of ephemera, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed. The ephemera is exactly that. And sort of look at it and chuck it.
Where do you go to find these old items, Mike?
Well, around and about every now and again, there are flea markets devoted to bus and train enthusiasts, which are often on preserved railways and sometimes at bus rallies, where people set up stall and sell their accumulated collections of stuff. And sometimes you can find some really, really good stuff in it. But it's quite a hunt because very often people collect, I think, stuff which is like photographs, which don't interest me at all. Old timetables, which, unless they've got a very stylish cover, they don't interest me either. So it's trying to find those pearls within that brackish water, if you like. So, yeah, it's quite a difficult thing to do.
Now, you talked about pearls. I wonder, can you maybe describe to us a few of the favourites in your collection, please, Mike?
Well, having already sort of slightly dismissed coach companies as being parsimonious in their employment of designers and artists. So in other words, just picking something, jobbing local. I do have about sort of 6, 7, 8 posters, which are really superb. In the latter part of bus and coach corporate life, there were two big groups of bus and coach companies. One was called the Transport Holding Company, commonly known as the Tilling Group, which was nationalised in 1948, and Southern Bechtis was part of that group. And the other group, which was just as big, was the British Electric Traction Company, which people might think, well, it was a tram company. Yes, it was, but later became obviously buses and coaches particularly. So what you had with those, and particularly with railway shareholder interest in both groups, was one group, particularly the Transport Holding, the nationalised one, sometimes employed rather good artists and sold the idea of what that artwork was going to be to any company within its group that actually could make use of that image. So it was actually quite an efficient way of commissioning quite nice stuff. And to take an example, there's a rather superb poster designer called Royston Cooper, who was just superb, and he did many posters in the early 60s, mid 60s, and just wonderful renditions of rural Britain and market town Britain and village Britain and seaside Britain in that rather wonderful, free-flowing, loose, colourful style, which when you see, if you see it, you go, oh, that's 50s, that's 60s. Yeah, so there is some really good stuff as well, but don't let anybody think that in saying that, that the whole genre is pretty good. It's not. It's a lot of it is fairly mundane and not especially amazing at all. But it's a rarity. It's the rarity of it. It's the social interest of it as well, particularly for companies' names that have long disappeared and destinations that are utterly out of favour. So who knows anything about 17 and sixpence for a fare from London to wherever? So, yes, it's lots of... It's sort of part nostalgia, part beauty, part whatever. And it's sort of timeless because rather like with railway, shipping and airline, it's a nostalgic age because what we don't have... Please feel free, anyone, to argue with me, but what we don't have in 2025 is glamour. There's no glamour. Glamour's gone because it's so much affordable by so many that exclusivity of stuff is largely gone.
There were some gems, basically, some real, real works of art almost in amongst them all.
Yes, and London Transport, who was one of the key, I mean, three companies probably stand out of the era between the 30s and the late 60s, excluding wartime years. Obviously, nothing was published in wartime. London Transport was remarkable in its output. Not always beautiful, but very high standard. Midland Red, which was an enormous company that served much of the Midlands, really, much lamented. It was very stylish. They even built their own vehicles. How clever were they? Their publicity machine was generally very, very good. And Royal Blue, the South West operator, nationalised. Midland Red, by the way, was private. The nationalised company Royal Blue, who had magnificent dark blue and cream vehicles, which sailed majestically from London to the South West. All points, every town and village seemed to be served. They produced the most wonderful literature, persuading people that the Southwest was the right place to do, and it was a beautiful area, which of course it is, and it still remains so, but sadly not really served in the way that it used to be. So, yes, they were not afraid to spend money, because they knew that spending money well would actually have a good result in terms of bookings and in terms of usage, and that's the whole point of good marketing.
Now, it all sounds like quite a hobby with some serious collectors. I mean, what kind of prices do some of these things sell from, Mike?
Buses and coaches are at the bottom end of the social spectrum, so they don't get the prices that shipping company stuff does, or airline stuff, or much railway stuff, which can go for hideously high prices. So bus and coach stuff, posters probably in the region of £100 to £250, depending on condition, is actually quite important, but it's not the main thing. The main thing is actually whether the image is actually a good image. It's something that you can live with on the wall. It's just the old test of artwork. Can I live with this or can't I? The stuff like leaflets, Fiverr, can go up if it's particularly rare or particularly beautiful to as much as 50. But it would generally be in the £5 to £15 bracket for a lot of it. If it's ugly old stuff, a couple of quid would probably do. But obviously, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and what I might consider ugly is other people's treasure. As with everything, it's subjective.
If you've sparked a bit of interest out there, Mike, how might somebody start exploring bus and coach marketing for the first time? What would you recommend?
Oh, it's very hard. It's very hard. There's very little out there as a guide to stuff. There's very little out there. I think it's a lot of self-learning. The principles would be followed very much on the railways and airlines models, and the principles are the same. It's just the examples and the particular executions and the particular people that are involved with that business are largely unknown. So it's a lot of just research and a lot of trial and error. But if you're a scholar, which is what you might be suggesting, that's going to be tough. If you're just a collector that likes nice things, like a sort of like magpies like shiny objects, well, I rather like a magpie with lovely design. I can't pretend to be gifted in the sense of being academic, but I can actually see something rather lovely to my eyes from quite a long way away and get it. It's a very hard one, Mark.
And you had one really good piece of advice for me, I remember, when I first met you, when I was starting to collect old posters. Can you remember what it was? Four words?
Oh, never trim a poster.
Well, next time you see a classic old transport poster or you hear someone saying how buses were better in the olden days, think of our guest, Mike Wharton, and the many other collectors and lovers of transport history. Thanks very much for being with us today, Mike.
My pleasure.
Hope you've enjoyed listening and learning as much as I have. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed.